You will know in due course by Acharya Swami. Once I mustered courage to put a question to Bhagavan about transmigration or reincarnation. I put my question in English, and it was translated by Swami Ramananda Saraswati. If, with the decay of the physical body, the light within reverts to the all-pervading light, how can there be any transmigration or reincarnation of the soul? He smilingly replied with a quotation from the Bhagavad Gita, meaning, "You will know in due course." You'll find out. I'm glad to say that after long and deep consideration, I have been able to fathom this sublime theory.
So that means he died?
Figured it out. Bhagavan, Sri Ramana Maharshi, said, "In yoga samadhi is used to indicate some kind of trance, and there are various kinds of samadhi. But the samadhi I speak to you about is different. It is sahaja samadhi. In this state, you remain calm and composed during activity. You realize that you are moved by the deeper real self within, and are unaffected by what you do or say or think. You have no worries, anxieties, or cares, for you realize that there is nothing that belongs to you as ego, and that everything is being done by something with which you are in conscious union." The Ever Present by Duncan Greenleaf. Quote, "It is expedient that I leave you," said Christ, "and herein is no cause for sorrow," said Buddha. One of Lord Buddha's last recorded sayings was, "All compounds must dissolve. Herein there is no cause for sorrow." That precious and beloved body, so long treasured in our hearts as Sri Bhagavan Ramana, was, as a physical vehicle, a compound, and had to separate in time into its component elements, disappearing from those eyes which so long delighted it with reverent affection. So too, Sri Krishna found it expedient that his gopi devotees be made to enrich their love for him by withdrawing his outward form from their adoring eyes. Then he sent Uddhava to hint to them how they could now be always in his presence and find him ever dancing in their hearts. When the eye of love has no longer to seek with yearning for the beloved outside, the eye of the inner heart is turned within and there realizes his living ecstatic presence. And so it has been with us. The inevitable happened on that April evening, 1950. And the dear body, which had been so long the center, the focus of our heart's gaze, ceased to delight our eyes. Can we say that he is dead? Bhagavan dead? The word could have no meaning. How can he who lives in all the universe ever taste of death? Quote, "You think I am going away, but where am I to go? I shall remain here with you," unquote. That was his promise while he was preparing us for the seeming separation. And those of us who have loved him here in Tiruvannamalai hold firmly to the faith, which we feel confirmed by continual experience, that he has kept that promise and is still to be contacted here in the ashram as of old. Like Sir Das, darkening the physical sight so that he might see clearly the light within, he has dimmed our outer sight to his radiance, only that the inner vision might be filled with his eternal light. He has veiled the outer form we love so well, that its beauty might no longer draw our gaze away from the everlasting presence enthroned in our inmost heart. Painful was the veiling to our human hearts, yet in these days of seeming deprivation, happy indeed are we if we be driven thereby inward, to see and love him there, shining as the heart of all, the ineffably radiant self, manifesting ever as the self of our self, the very being of our being, the ever blessed awareness of all truth, the stillness of omnipresent bliss, Satchitananda. Our hearts were kindled to deep affection while he taught us by word and example, which he silently showered the nectar, drew the nectar of grace upon all. Today, they turn to him within, by day and night, no less than of old. And they rejoice to find that grace wells up unceasingly from the fountain of oneself, who alone is all wisdom, love, and power. At his tender feet that trod the mountain path so long for us, a grateful love and undying memory we lay. May he accept these poor gifts of our hearts and pour grace and pour his grace on all who wander in the darkness of the unknown tracks of primal ignorance. His light shines with the everlasting clarity of God's own light. Maharshi Ramana and Self-Inquiry by Sri La Sri Pandrimale Swamigo. Great saints like Maharshi Ramana, who have attained self-realization and lived in the stage of eternal supreme consciousness, have disseminated spiritual knowledge among seekers of truth to ennoble their lives. Maharshi Ramana has chosen the path of knowledge for serving humanity. His teaching through Atma Vichara, that is, inquiry within who am I, and tracing the mind to its primal source as a sadhana for self-realization, has enabled many a spiritual aspirant to still the mind and realize the true self as a self-effulgent omnipresent spirit. By abiding in mona, or silence, he radiated serene calmness and peace, shanti, all around. It is but befitting that the mountain path should have brought out a special giant in number to reveal to the world the greatness of Maharshi Ramana, the Sadguru. Quote from Bhagavan Sri Ramana Maharshi: the individual being, which identifies its existence with that of the life in the physical body as I, is called the ego. The self, which is pure consciousness, has no ego sense about it. Neither can the physical body, which is inert in itself, have this ego sense. Between the two, that is, between the self, or pure consciousness, and the inert physical body, there arises mysteriously the ego sense, or I notion, the hybrid, which is neither of them. And this flourishes as an individual being. This ego, or individual being, is at the root of all that is futile and undesirable in life. Therefore, it is to be destroyed by any possible means. Then that which ever is alone remains resplendent, This is liberation or enlightenment or self-realization. An obituary of Dr. Evan Wetz.
Oh.
He was a Ramanashram in 1935. He translated the Mala Rinpo book and the Tibetan Book of the Dead.
But there was some controversy about him, right?
No. He lived in California, and he had, although not specifically attached to this ashram, Dr. Evan Wentz was at one time a well-known figure here. A profound student of Tibetan Buddhism, he made himself widely known by his translation of the Tibetan Book of the Dead and the life of Milarepa. After leaving Tibet, he came here to learn from Bhagavan, and a number of his questions and Bhagavan's replies to them, especially on the subject of sadhana for Westerners, are to be found in talks with Sri Ramana Maharshi. We learned that he passed away in California, where he was living in retirement, on 17th July this year, 1966.
How come you didn't do an obituary for Bhagavati?
Well, you know, she wasn't that much in the ashram.
It's like he was associated. We have a cadenza.
Introducing Krishna Bhikshu. And another one, Sri Krishna Prem. Yet another loved and esteemed figure whose passing we deplore is Sri Krishna Prem. An Englishman in his Purva Ashram, he has long been known as a devotional worshipper of Sri Krishna in his ashram in Mirtola. He came here once in the lifetime of Bhagavan, for whom he had the most profound reverence. In April 1964, we published a letter of his felicitating the infant mountain path and wishing it well. He died in November 13th and will be remembered, long be remembered and regretted. Krishna Bhikshu and the Bhikshu is a technical appellation, not implying monk or mendicant, like its Buddhist equivalent, is well known to our readers as author of the important articles Chakra at Ramanashram and Above Orthodoxy and Unorthodoxy in October 1965, both showing a wealth of reminiscences about Bhagavan and familiarity with aspects of his teaching not often publicized. He is a man of unsatiable curiosity, keen intellect, and a variety of interests, one hard to get the better of in conversation, and indeed apt to give a headache to the other party. You know, he wrote the Ramana Leela, a Telugu biography of Bhagavan. He was born in 1904 in an unorthodox and reformist family, and grew up not merely a non-believer, but an active disbeliever in Hinduism. A precocious youth, he read all that was available on the Brahmo Samaj and began to wonder whether what was written against Hindu tradition was not true. He read widely and began to study philosophy, but acquired a distaste for religious literature. He took an interest in history also, became proficient in Telugu literature, and began to study law for profession. The great change in his life came in 1927, at the age of 23, when he was studying law in Madras and met Kavya Kanta Ganapati Muni, the outstanding tantric devotee of Bhagavan, about whom there's an article in our issue of April 1965. Powerfully influenced by him, he turned to sadhana, using japa or incantation as he did. He came to Tiruvannamalai with Ganapati Muni, Nayana as he was called, and a few years later Bhagavan indicated to him the proper laksha, spiritual aim, for his sadhana. His restless mind drove him to visit other swamis also. He frequently went to Sri Aurobindo for darshan. He visited Sri Yogesh Babu of Banaras to get an insight into psychology, and Sri Kamakoti and others to acquire a thorough knowledge of Hindu orthodoxy and its justification. Influenced by a remark of Swami Siddheshwarananda of the Ramakrishna Mission, later to be for many years its representative in France, that he should seek rather to express than to repress his intellectual propensities. He became a poet, dramatist, actor, and astrologer, giving little thought to his practice of law. For a while he followed the Raja Yoga taught by Sri Ram Lal Mahaprabhu of Amritsar. Having heard an exposition of the Brahma Sutras and Bhagavata by Sri Mandalika Venkata Sastri, a famous pundit of Yaglore, to whom the Kanchi Shankaracharya gave the title of Sastra Ratnakara, he decided to learn Sanskrit and read the scriptures for himself. And this time also Sri Medha Vayupu Sastri of Kurunul initiated him into Advaitic sadhana. His mode of spiritual practice was confirmed in 1939 when Bhagavan authorized him to continue pranayama and pranava japa. As a result of his wide study and long practice, Krishna Bhikshu became convinced of the truth and value of Hindu tradition and is now always prepared to defend it when attacked. Despite his wandering from guru to guru and his sampling of various studies, he became convinced that Bhagavan was safeguarding and controlling him throughout, and that the feet of Bhagavan were his sole shelter. He was a frequent visitor at the ashram, but only settled down here permanently after Bhagavan had left the body. He expects to spend the rest of his life here. Krishna Bhikshu is the author of Sri Ramana Leela, a lucid and informative biography of Bhagavan in Telugu. He has also written a commentary, not yet published, on the Arunachala Pancharatnam. He has translated the Tripura Rahasya into Telugu and written a number of Telugu poems and dramas on the behest of the woman saint of Jalalamodi Amagaru. He translated Valmiki's Ramayana into Telugu prose. Now he is concentrating on japa, the form of sadhana with which he has most affinity. And here's a little write-up on Ramaswami Pillai. Is one of the senior-most devotees still living here. He used to visit Bhagavan right back in the Skanda Ashram days and became a permanent resident of the ashram in 1922, a year when the present ashram at the foot of the hill was founded. He was a college-educated young man with a robust body and genial disposition and was from the start noticeable for the zest with which he had tackled the many kinds of manual labor that were necessary for building up the ashram. Years later, when the present building had been erected, the laborers were employed. He was a person in charge of ashram labor and never minded lending a hand himself when anything had to be done. He was an asset to the ashram office in many ways, being always ready to go into town to make purchases or do whatever needed to be done. In later years, when Bhagavan's knees were badly swollen with rheumatism, and Ramaswami Pillai himself was already well advanced into middle age, Bhagavan slipped and fell one day in his daily walk on the hill, injuring his foot. Without a word to anyone, Ramaswami Pillai set out next day to make the path up the hill, shoring up the steep slope into steps, chiseling steps in the slabs of rock, putting a firm stone edge to the path. From dawn to dusk he worked single-handed for weeks together until the path was made. Little is done to keep it in repair now that Bhagavan is no longer here in the body to walk on it, but after all the years of monsoon rain beating down on it, the path still remains. So thoroughly did Ramaswami Pillai do his work. He is a member of the ashram committee, which has set up to assist the management after the Mahasamadhi of Bhagavan till its dissolution in 1964. Another outstanding feature about him is his love of spiritual songs. He has a stentorian voice and a vast repertoire, and every day, morning and evening, he still joins with a few like-minded devotees in a session of devotional singing, Tamo Parayana, initiated by Bhagavan himself, consisting of hymns composed by various poet saints and of the Tamo land, including Bhagavan.
Outside. I was able to park this morning, sir.
Disappearance of the body, a note from Alan Chadwick. One day, Bhagavan was telling us that the Tamil saint Manika Bhattacharya's body disappeared in a blaze of light, leaving no residue. I asked him how that happened, and he explained that the body is only the solidified mind. When the mind dissolves in jnana and consumes itself in a blaze of light, the body also is burnt up in the process. He mentioned other such cases also. I referred to the story in the Bible of Elijah being carried to heaven in a chariot of fire, a poetic way of saying the same thing. I then asked whether Christ's disappearance from the tomb resembled this in any way. But Bhagavan pointed out the difference that Christ's body still remained, whereas in the other type of phenomena, the body was entirely consumed. He explained that the subtle body is composed of light and sound, and the gross body is only a concrete form of this. Whose Will Be Done by Dr. T.N. Krishna Swami. Prayer, parading one's weakness before God and asking that one's will be done, is useless. Even though a man may be praying for others, it is fundamentally his own happiness that he is seeking. To pray for anything is offering resistance to the free play of God's will. Nothing should be allowed to come between God and the seeker, not even a prayer. To be still and surrender oneself to God is to abide by His will. This does not mean that one should be inactive in life, only that one should learn to lead a non-volitional life. Quote, when all actions are performed by the qualities of nature, only he who is confused by the ego sense imagines himself to be the actor, unquote, in the Bhagavad Gita. Quote, a true master will not ask the seeker to do this or that. The seeker has to gain cessation of mental activities. The active mind creates, and such creation destroys one's self nature. Becoming destroyed being, unquote. Said Bhagavan. The aim is simply to be inwardly still and to be aware. Effort must be made to still thoughts, and there is awareness of the effort. and of the thought still. Quote, all our experiences are only thought. Pleasure and pain are thoughts, and thoughts are within us. Pleasure and pain are not in the outer world. The kingdom of heaven and this world are not two different things. When the world is seen as within you, it turns into the kingdom of heaven, unquote. God's presence is not a living reality in the world as we see it because man's mind is actively arranging the things of the world. Therefore, it is logically correct to say that God is absent from the world. And where God is absent, all doubts and fears are bound to be present. That which is aware of the sorrows of the world is the contracted ego. While the world is the expanded ego. So the evil in the world is inseparable from the ego which comprises it. And will last as long as the ego. Quote, until the I riddle is solved, the world riddle will remain to perplex and torment us. And when the self is seen, the world is not. Then one realizes that there never was any creation, unquote. How can there be suffering in the uncreated? Or what is there to ask for? Quote, one who says, I shall not strive for my own salvation till I have received the suffering of the whole world, is like the compassionate dreamer who first wants to relieve the sufferings of the people in a dream before consenting to wake up, unquote. Those who want to do social work are like such an amiable philosopher. It is the outgoing mind that entertains such apparently compassionate thoughts. The mind should not be occupied outwardly, but turn inward. Its power should be used to stop its habit of thinking. There is a state in which thoughts do not come, not even the I am thought, and yet awareness remains. There are no problems for such a skilled mind or still mind. It is not necessary for the self to be aware of the world, but only to be. Awareness of the world can be added to self-awareness or not. It doesn't matter. The self, being all, loses nothing by being aware of the world or by being aware of the world. The self, being all, loses nothing by being aware of the world or by being unaware of the world. It has abiding peace and happiness whether aware of the world or not. One should not lose sight of his I in any circumstances. So long as he clings to it, there is no harm in his leading an active life or doing philanthropic work. It is only the I am the doer illusion that is harmful. The main aim should be to hold the mind constantly to the I thought. This is the only remedy for the ills of the world. The only way to know God in this world is to know oneself. One should not seek for God in the world but in oneself. Life's sorrows serve a purpose insofar as they spur the mind to seek God. One should turn away from the world and look inwards to meet the Divine Presence. The Upanishad puts it, quote, the total subsidence of the ego is the end of the world and is termed Shiva, the auspicious, unquote. Suffering is rooted in ignorance. Ignorance is removed by knowledge of the Spirit. This knowledge showed that the ego and the world to which we cling are fundamentally foreign to us and therefore cause suffering. The true teaching helps us to escape from the world, which is synonymous with bondage and suffering. This is all about prayer. Modes of Prayer by Indira Devi. On page 234 of our issue in October 1964, there's a short note of Dilip Kumar Roy followed by his account of how he came to the Maharshi. We give here a letter that he wrote to two of his Western disciples, kindly sending us a copy, in which he quotes his ecstatic disciple Indra Devi's description of the three types of prayer often mentioned by Christian mystics, that is, petition, adoration, and contemplation. I was speaking about the three types of prayer the Western mystics so often describe: petition, adoration, and contemplation. And I was trying to explain, Indra Devi went off into a bhava samadhi and spoke in a state of ecstasy, intermittently patting her own head, as she often does, to be able to retain her normal consciousness. "You know, Dada," she said, "a devotee of Krishna, a gopi cowherd maid, Miss Gopal, who had gone away to Mathura, she simply yearned for him. One day she heard that Gopal had just returned to Vrindavan. He was overjoyed and set out for his abode. On her way she was thinking delightedly of all that she would say to Gopal, rehearsed how she was going to greet him, wondered what she would ask him, how she would implore him to write to her in future without fail and to send her messages of his grace, etc. And above all, he must play his heavenly flute of bliss now that he is back again," and so on and so forth. Indra looked at me, added succinctly, "This is a petitionary prayer." But then, she went on, as she draws near her destination, she feels thrilled. She crosses his courtyard, and her heart is flooded with joy. A deep pace descends. A peace descends into her soul. She marvels what is going to happen to her. How will Gopal receive her? How she will fall at his feet? How she will react to his glance? And so on. She draws still nearer Gopal's sanctum, approaches the door in ecstasy of tears. But still, she has not met him, even though she hears his beloved footfall on the other side. Her heart would wing its way to him, but the door is still closed. She waits in ecstasy, adoring her heart's one beloved, whom she has yet to meet face to face. This, added Indra, is adoration. Then she resumed, in a thick voice after a brief pause, "The door opens at long last, and there stands her peerless Gopal, the world heart charmer. And lo, time stops, and her thoughts are still. All she wants to say dissolves, and how can she think of anything to say when she meets the one from whom she has lived all these days, the only one from whom life is worth living, a bliss that passes all understanding pervades her being, and he smiles at her, and she gazes at him, self-lost. There is only communion, the blessed fulfillment of oneness of the soul and her swine of Vrindavan, locked in the last clasp of love." Her tremulous voice trailed off into silence. Then she looked at me, her eyes moist with tears, and said, "This is contemplation." By which she meant, of course, samadhi. At intervals, a translation by Professor K. Swaminathan from the Tamil of Muruganar. You meditate at intervals. Talk not of intervals, just be the self, in one unbroken thread. Hair after itching hair of thought, who would pluck out, when what's to do is shave the whole scalp clean. Buddhism, Theravada, by Venerable Fra Maha Vichitur Tissadatta. The Buddhist rosary of 108 beads, this number represents craving in all its forms, whereby every being is bound to experience some kind of suffering in every type of existence. The Buddhist rosary itself symbolizes the way of getting rid of craving, step by step. The practice of the rosary consists in recalling to mind the virtues of the Buddha by repeating the syllables of the Pali words used in this recollection while counting the beads of the rosary one by one. The Pali words for the meditation with the rosary are spoken, either aloud or mentally, with the syllables in both normal and reverse order, thus, that's a long thing here. It goes TP so, so TP, Bhagava, Bhagabha. You know all that? It goes down for a paragraph. Each syllable corresponds to one bead of like the rosary. According, we have 108 beads and 108 syllables. The English translation of this recollection would be as follows. It is for this reason that the Blessed One, the soul purified, perfectly enlightened, endowed with knowledge and conduct, well-fared, a knower of all the world, peerless, charioteer of men, to be tamed, teacher of gods and men, the awakened one, the Blessed One. While practicing, one should be mindful of the meaning of the syllables. If one misses even one syllable in the meditation, one must start again, right from the beginning. Mindfulness and dedication are very necessary for this meditation. The object of the practice is not only to gain concentration, but to suppress and remove the 108 kinds of craving. Quote from Bhagavan Sri Ramana Maharshi. When the japa becomes continuous, all other thoughts cease, and one is in one's real nature, which is invocation or absorption. We turn our minds outwards to things of the world, and are therefore not aware that our real nature is always invocation. When by conscious effort, our invocation or meditation, as we call it, we prevent our minds from thinking of other things, then what remains is our real nature, which is invocation. So long as you think you are the name and form, you can't escape name and form in invocation also. When you realize you are not name and form, the name and form will drop off of themselves. No other effort is necessary. Invocation or meditation will lead to it naturally and as a matter of course. Invocation, which is now regarded as the means, will then be found to be the goal. There is no difference between God and His name. Quote from Swami Ramdas, so long as we think we are doing something ourselves as an individual beings, we are merely struggling and achieving nothing spiritually. When we know that the divine power active in the universe is responsible for all that we do, the idea, I am the doer, disappears. When the ego sense rises in us, the whole game is spoiled. We are caught up in the meshes of karma. Sometimes we are happy, sometimes unhappy.